This is New Classical Tracks from listener-supported American Public Media. If you're enjoying this podcast, the best thing that you can do for this show is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Cellist Sophie Hsiao is very modest about her accomplishments. I mean, here's just a few of them. She started off playing cello in elementary school in Houston, Texas. At 13, she made it into the Curtis Institute. Then she went off to Yale for her undergrad and graduate program. Oh, and then she won an Avery Fisher Career Grant. Now she's teaching at the University of Connecticut, and she just put out her second recording. On that recording, you hear her play a cello once owned by Pablo Casals. This is a delightful recording. It's filled with the joy of life, and the music is inspired by France. She calls it Can-Can Macabre. That's what we hear about this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. Sophie, thank you so much for joining me to talk about your new recording and to introduce yourself to us, because this may be the first time that some of our listeners are discovering Sophie Hsiao. So would you tell us a little bit about you and how the cello became such an important part of who you are?
Well, I played the cello for a very long time. I first started as a Suzuki player in my elementary school in Houston, Texas. And I went to the Curtis Institute when I was 13. And I really studied cello very seriously. And then I went to Yale for college and master's degree. And since then, I was kind of freelancing, playing concerts. I played a lot of chamber music with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. And then I had the Avery Fisher Career Grant. So I was playing kind of recitals and some concertos with orchestras. But yeah, so it's always been a part of my life from a very young age. And now I am teaching at the University of Connecticut. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I've been a lot of places because of the cello, and I know how to fly with the cello. And I've gotten to do a lot of different things as a cellist, like play in an orchestra. I played in the National Symphony for a year, and I've gotten to play solo with wonderful orchestras like the Houston Symphony, and I've played a lot of recitals, as this CD is, and also a lot of chamber music with different players. So I've gotten to know a lot of people, and I love working with students as well.
You said you've learned how to fly with the cello. What have you learned?
I've learned that they can bump you off the plane for so many reasons. Especially flying internationally, the whole passport thing is very difficult with, I think they count the number of passengers on the plane. And I have been in the habit of just buying another ticket for the cello. It sits in a seat because it can't go under without being damaged or just kind of thrown around. And also the temperature changes in the cargo is not okay for the instrument. So, yeah, I've learned that you do have to get that all settled in advance. And now they actually change the method so that you can buy a cabin baggage. So for anyone who wants to just have an extra seat next to them, it's much easier to purchase that now.
Well, you have a very precious cello. It was once owned by Pablo Casals. Can you tell us about this beautiful instrument, please?
Yeah. It's an Honoré d'Arezzé, made around 1855. It's possible it's not what that is, because labels on instruments are not always put there by the maker, the correct maker. But I bought it from Marta Casals Istomin, so it is indeed Casals' instrument. And I think they acquired it in 1955, and it lived, I think, in Puerto Rico, because he had an instrument in Europe where he played on primarily, and then he had this instrument in the States. So when I first bought it, it had gut strings on it, and it had been in their possession since then. So it felt really special. I felt like it sounded like him when I first got it.
I am curious about that. Do you ever feel maybe like you're channeling him a little bit when you're playing?
Well, you know, the instrument did change with me. But when you first get it, what the wood is doing is just amplifying the sounds that you make. So whatever has been vibrated a certain way vibrates easier, right? So it was vibrating very easily on so many notes. And it's now set up differently. We added more tension to have it project a little more. It was actually, I think, his voice until it became mine. So I think you can approach it like that. It's in there with energy and vibrations, but I think there's also a science to what is happening.
Wonderful. Now, did I hear you say that you grew up in Houston? Is that right?
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about your roots.
Well, Houston has a really strong public school program and also a fairly large Asian community. And so those two together, we had really nice music schools to go to, music magnet programs. So I started cello at a public school that was, you know, one block from me. And my cello teacher is still around in Greensboro, North Carolina now. And a bunch of us who started in Suzuki on different instruments like violin, cello, are still professional musicians. So it had a good output. But yes, Houston is, as they say, it's extremely hot. It's over air conditioned on the inside. But there was a lot of music going on, and it was a wonderful place to learn music.
Now, were your parents musicians, or are they musicians as well?
Yes.
Tell me about how music became so important to you in general.
My mother is a piano teacher, and in fact, she taught the current head of Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, Wuhan, piano in Taiwan. And I think, you know, when I look at music education, which is what I'm in now too, it's just something you do. So it's something you can do together. You don't necessarily have to have aspirations, although you should have concerts, otherwise it wouldn't be very much fun. But yeah, so she was always teaching piano in the house, so I heard a lot of piano repertoire. I still feel very comfortable listening to the piano. And apparently I used to, you know, hang out under the piano before there were babysitters taking care of me. So I would and kind of tickle their feet. They're like, wait, what's going on? So I'm very used to the sound of music and pitches going on. But the actual study of music was at school in a magnet program. And yeah, it didn't get serious until I had a private teacher, and then I heard Jacqueline Dupre's Elgar Concerto, and it wouldn't leave my head for a very long time. So I was caught.
You were mentioning how important it is to have some concerts or performances if you're going to play an instrument, because otherwise, why are you doing it? I mean, you could just be doing it for fun, but it is nice to share your music. And that's what we're here to talk about today, is your latest recording. You actually have several recordings to your credit. So where does this one fall in line with the others? Is this number 5 or 6 or?
I'm not quite sure in that, like, I've collaborated with other people for their recordings, so I don't know whether to count them or not. So, yes. I can't answer that question.
How many solo recordings do you have?
probably this is only my second. I have the Bach solo suites, and I also recorded Howard Shore's Mythic Gardens, which I also commissioned. That's also on a recording with Long Long, and it's Howard Shore's album, so I don't know what to call that, but yes.
So I'm just going to point out that you say all these things very nonchalantly and like they're just kind of like everybody does this, but you've done some pretty special things to be able to plan a recording that also features Long Long and to win an Avery Fisher Career Grant. I mean, that's very significant.
Thank you.
And so bravo to you.
Thank you so much,
for
Julie.
Doing so many amazing things and now also sharing it through your work as a teacher, too. So
thank you.
I'm sure your students are very excited to be able to work with you. You mentioned that this new recording was a recital program. Is that correct?
Not exactly. The recording was conceived to showcase a piece that I commissioned from Herschel Garfein. And I actually commissioned the piece with the intention of it being a piece that I could pair with a Debussy cello sonata, which, you know, is actually kind of a perfect piece of music in its length and in its kind of story. So then the other pieces that were along with it kind of illustrated other aspects of that music.
Tell me the title and where it comes from.
The Cancan Macabre is actually the name of the last movement of Thomas Addis's Rediscovered Places, Lieux Retrouvés.
Well, I'm going to dive into each of the pieces, but I'm curious how that title encompasses, you know, the theme of the program that we're going to hear on this recording.
Well, one of the important kind of lines through all the pieces, other than the cello, is kind of a connection to Paris. And I feel like that vaudeville, which is the last movement of Thomas Addis's piece, has this like sensual pleasures, like just all the pleasures that you could ever want, like way too much of it. So I think that's kind of where that ties in. So François Couperin was one of the most famous French Baroque composers. And I felt like that kind of joy, like that kind of like mood of like wanting each movement to be its own thing, its own exquisite kind of good feeling is in his music. And, you know, transferred to Thomas Addis as well. So there's kind of this joy that they hope to give you by writing each movement to be as concise and precise and giving off that aura as much as possible.
You do lead off this program with a set of concert pieces by Couperin. Why was this the right way to start the recording?
Well, it's from 300 years ago, so it preceded everything else. And yeah, I think it sets up what style came after. So specifically to the set of pieces that are French, like Debussy, Thomas Addis, and Chopin was also writing for a French cellist, a Parisian cellist. There's kind of really needing for every sound to be long and to be refined. So there's a sparseness, not sparse, but like everything in its own place. So I think that leads off very well, showing that kind of precision and organization in the music.
Sophie, you mentioned that the Debussy Sonata for cello and piano in D minor is very important to you. You wanted to be sure to record it. Why? Why is it so important to you?
I play it a lot. Once I played it in Carnegie Hall, and the music itself was so old. My friends were like, it's like the Shroud of Turin. It's just, he's one of the great composers of the 20th century. And he basically started his own kind of school of tradition that was not Germanic, and in a very innovative, creative way. This is different from his other works in that it actually has a character in it. Piero Lunaire, who was mimed a lot at that time. And the story is that he rouses with a start, which is the first movement. You can totally hear Debussy in his sound world in the middle of it, where there's kind of cathedral-like chords. And I can hear like bells going on and ringing. And I can almost hear Piero like just in there, like getting hit by all of these. So by the end of the movement, which is very short, the whole piece itself is 12 minutes long. So it's, again, miniature and precise, but like he's awake and peaceful. The second movement is so much fun. It's got jazz in it. It's called Serenade, Serenade. And it's the story of him serenading the moon, which, you know, when you're out at night, it looks like the moon is following you along. And so, of course, like he's in love with the moon and is interested in doing something since it's nighttime. And so there's a bunch of like all these gestures of seduction. But of course, like nothing comes of it. And so the third movement, it segues into the third movement. And it's his song of liberty, like, I don't need the moon, I'm fine. So it's just, it's funny, it's fun, it's joyous, and it all happens in 12 minutes.
The Layers is the piece that you commissioned. The composer is Herschel Garfein. How do you know this composer?
I first, as a freelancer, was playing in the Five Boroughs Music Festival, which is a festival in New York City. And they were celebrating all the compositions that they commissioned over the years. So, and from the Five Boroughs of New York. So I also first played a piece by Jesse Montgomery there, and I remember the pieces that really stuck with me, and I played a piece called The Cyclone, which was with a singer and piano, and it was thrilling. I mean, Herschel has a unique voice, and he's from the borough of Brooklyn. So when I was looking for a piece to commission, I went to him and I asked him to write it as a companion piece to the WC.
And this has a storyline as well, like the Debussy. Can you share that storyline, which gets into the layers that are reflected in this work?
Yeah, the piece itself is much more philosophical. It's based on a poem by Stanley Kunitz with a protagonist. The poet is looking back at a longish life, so this is an older person, and kind of with a heavy heart, looking at what they've loved and therefore isn't with them anymore. So one of the beautiful quotes is, the loves are scattered. Basically, the poet needs to gather themselves with this heaviness of, you know, like kind of sadness at having the past be the past and not the present, and having to gather themselves to move on. So the first movement is called Scavenger Angels, and he wanted the title to kind of depict the discrepancy between the cruelty and indifference of scavengers. The benevolence of angels. So those two themes are in the first movement. And the second movement is actually what does connect to Debussy in its title, When the Moon Was Covered. The poet is talking through a nimbus cloud, which, you know, is kind of gray, and so it's floating. I think it's very French in its kind of affect. The last movement is called Every Stone on the Road. The titles are from key phrases in the poem. And it's kind of a celebration since it uses a klezmer tune, which is like what is played on life's happiest occasions, like weddings, you know, all these ceremonies. But the tonality itself has kind of a sad twinge to it. So, yeah, Every Stone on the Road kind of celebrates and, you know, acknowledges every little bump, and as a kind of celebration of life itself.
Get to the Thomas Addis piece, which he kind of refers to this as water music in this piece. Is that right? Can you tell us a little bit more about you know, how water is represented in this work?
Well, the first movement is called The Waters. So that sets up the theme of the piece. I think to some extent, he's also like, there's a lot of meta in this piece. So you're looking at the water, but it makes you think, it's like your memory of what it was when you were with it. The first movement is gorgeous in its cascading lines that just are so, you can just hear water flowing. The cello takes over the line and then it kind of starts to swirl. And then that dissipates. The second movement, The Mountain, I think there are mountaineers. So it's not exactly water anymore, but it's still pictorial, and I'm sure there's water around the mountain. And there's two mountaineers, so each one is singing the same tune, the cello being one and the piano being the other. But they're climbing up this craggy mountain at different rates, and that's where he starts to use meter play. What's really fun about this is, like, I've often looked at my friends and, like, known that they're just in different tempos, right? And so this really reflects the way two people are climbing up this mountain at different rates. And they kind of meet up, but they're definitely in different complicated meters, and it's very jazzy in that way. And it ends with a planting of a flag at the top. The third movement is very, I think what you're alluding to is that the whole thing is very seamless. And so the phrases kind of overlap and they're in arcs. And so I can see a field. It's very sparsely written, very few notes in this, but very long lines. And you just see animals like resting. And then the phrases just keep going, but they just go higher and higher. And you can kind of hear the breaths of the animals like dissipate. And it's definitely the highest it's ever gone on the cello up to now that you can write for the cello without having no more notes. And then the last movement is the romp. It's just every pleasure you can have in a town. And in excess. So, like, too much of everything, sliding, harmonics. So he uses a lot of extended techniques in this last movement that the cello normally does not sound like.
He wrote this piece for Stephen Isserles, and I was reading Stephen Isserles's comments about the work. And he says, you know, he grabbed influences from everywhere, from Offenbach to jazz, from the French Baroque. And by doing that, he created his own individual language. Is that what you're feeling as well as you're playing this piece?
Oh, for sure. I mean, he wrote it so well, so it's just all there. So if you just follow his instructions, if you just play the right notes at the right time, which, by the way, is very hard to do. But yeah, definitely, he just grabbed everything and put it in there. So, I mean, the allusion to Offenbach is the can-can is yum bum beep bop bum 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 bum. So, that is pretty much like the meter that he used for the last movement. And the Couperin, yeah, that's actually one of the reasons I chose Couperin for the CD, because he wrote that about that being a major influence. But Ligeti, basically everything he took from everywhere to create his own language.
And you wrap things up with the Largo from Chopin's Sonata for Piano and Cello, and this is actually one of the very few pieces that Chopin wrote not just for piano. So what does that mean to you as a cellist?
Well, we're grateful for it. We're always so happy to have pieces by composers that feature the cello, and this does it so well. This movement fit so well in the CD because of, I keep saying CD, album, digital album, because it had those long flowing lines, just like in the Thomas Addis, slow movement, the third movement, and Herschel Garfein's second movement as well. As a cellist, a lot of the new works written for it are really gratefully received. We don't have that much solo repertoire because we're often playing in ensembles with other people. And it's not like violin where we also borrow from. So we're really grateful to have this wonderful kind of like cyclical late work of Chopin's.
And why did you want to close the recording with this piece?
So that third movement is often used as an encore because it's so beautiful on its own. So that's why I wanted to bring people down from potentially, you know, ending with a can-can macabre and wanting, like, ending with way too much energy. We actually recorded the whole piece, but it didn't fit on the CD, so it's actually available on Spotify if they want to hear the whole Chopin Sonata as well.
Oh, lovely. And he dedicated it to, or wrote it for, a French cellist?
Right. They're usually friends with, Auguste Franchomme. Usually they're friends with a cellist. So that reminds me I need to make more friends with composers. And so they write it for their friends and they play it with their friends. We're lucky that these cellists through the ages have gotten them to write music for them.
Sophie, as you were putting this recording together, what did you discover about yourself? And maybe it was something that surprised you.
That's an interesting question, Julie. you have to face, in the recording editing studio, some of your imperfections and get over them very quickly as the time is running. I discovered I can ornament more, always. I also, you learn what the instrument is like, the cello itself. And Pablo Casals wanted an instrument that he had to kind of fight. Like he was very muscular, despite being somewhat short. And he wanted to really power the cello in. And so this cello has a tendency to kind of mute what you do. And so I had to learn how to kind of bring it out. So in the recording studio, when we were listening back with edits, I was like, oh, this needs to be more. That needs to be more. So that was what I learned about me and the cello together.
The recording is called Can Can Macabre with cellist Sophie Schau. Thanks to Valerie Kaler. She's our producer for New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Mocker.